Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The use of mobile phone apps to track COVID-19 cases sounded like a good idea last spring. In the months since, a number of states have started using such apps, but the various approaches and the results have been uneven. David Uberti covers cybersecurity for the Wall Street Journal. He's been reporting about contact tracing apps. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So there was a lot of optimism about this, about technology's role in helping us track and combat COVID-19. That doesn't seem to have panned out. How come?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly was a lot of optimism. I mean, if you think about it, with the amount of things that we do on our phones, it makes sense at some conceptual level that we could, you know, use technology to help us track the spread of this virus. But at the end of the day, policy really makes a difference. And in this case, the disjointed policy from Washington, not having some sort of signal from federal lawmakers or officials as to how to approach this issue of technology and mobile phone apps, really left states to deduce this on their own, which created this you know, proverbial patchwork of different apps across state lines, which has really limited the effectiveness of these things to work.
Did they give any direction at the top from at the federal level?
There was very little direction. I mean, as with many public health decisions in the United States, Washington allows state health departments to make those decisions, and there's plenty of merits to that. But when it comes to technology and the amount of travel in between states or internationally, you know, between countries and borders, it does help to have that sort of compatibility between both policies and technology. And we didn't really have that in this case.
Is there any evidence around the world that there was that compatibility and that it was more effective?
Well, Europe has certainly been more aggressive about approaching mobile phone apps. Countries across the European Union, the vast majority of them, have used an infrastructure to develop apps put out by Google and Apple, which uses Bluetooth technology to essentially send anonymized key codes between phones to identify if you've come into contact with an infected person. There's been a lot of work between countries in Europe to help those apps be compatible with one another, and they're certainly far ahead of the United States to make that happen. You know, that said, in the United States, there's also efforts to create sort of centralized databases of those key codes to allow, you know, users between New York and Pennsylvania and New Jersey, states where there's a lot of cross-border travel, mm-hmm. to essentially download similar apps and be able to send those keys to one another if they cross state lines.
And are they doing that? I mean, are there groups of states that are trying to do that?
You know, there certainly is. I mean, over the course of the pandemic, I think one of the interesting threads that we've seen, you know, broadly at a public health perspective, is the growth of regional collaboration mm-hmm. on public health responses. So you've seen that on the West Coast with states such as Washington, Oregon, and California, and then on the East Coast with states like New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, among others. That has also played out with regard to mobile phone apps on the East Coast in New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey. Those four states have all contracted the same developer to create their mobile phone apps, which allows them to have a little bit more compatibility between these tools. So while the upload rates and the number of people who are actually using these apps is relatively low compared to the entire population, you do have more success in terms of messaging, getting people to get on board with these sorts of things, and then also allowing them to work across state lines, which is pretty crucial if we want to, you know, incorporate this type of technology into a broader response.
Yeah, I don't know anybody who's using a contact tracing app. I just don't know anybody. How common is it? What do we know?
I mean, it really depends on your state. Yeah. Ohio has not rolled out a contact tracing app. About 10 states in Washington, D.C. have rolled out official contact tracing apps. Several more have started pilot programs, and several additional states have told me that they're exploring apps. So all in all, we have about 24 states across the country that have rolled these things out. But in terms of uptake, you know, it's usually in the sort of low to mid single digits on the number of people across any given state that might have downloaded this stuff. So, you know, when you talk to public health officials about sort of the broader toolkit that they use to address the coronavirus pandemic, you know, they emphasize that this is really just one tool that they have alongside mask wearing alongside more aggressive testing regimes, et cetera. This isn't some sort of silver bullet that some people in the tech community thought it would be, say, in April or May of this year.
So how do they work? I mean, I guess all things being equal, how do they, what's the premise of them?
Well, there's a couple of different ways states or countries could approach this sort of technology. Early in the pandemic, there was much more interest in using GPS technology, which essentially tracks your location, which would allow public health officials to see, you know, Anne going to a specific restaurant and interacting with a person who has previously tested positive for the coronavirus. That raised a lot of privacy concerns. And over the course of the pandemic, states and countries around the world have really shied away from that, and they've gravitated toward this Google and Apple framework, which uses only Bluetooth technology. So all it will tell you is whether you come into proximity with someone who has tested positive for the COVID-19 virus and also entered, allowed the app to create a code that will send to other phones. So it gives you some, you know, visibility into your exposure to the coronavirus, but it would not tell you, for example, where you came into contact with this person or who that person might be. It will merely say that you were close by someone for about 15 minutes or so who has previously tested positive. So the question then is whether it will affect people's behavior, whether people, after they get that notification, will decide to get a test or decide to quarantine, which is really an open question.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of contact tracing, I think of, and you know, when we talk about it, the old-fashioned ways where you sit down and you are interviewed and you tell somebody where you've been and how long you were there and that kind of a thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I think the important thing to remember when we talk about contact tracing in the traditional sense, that it is quite an invasive process, right? You have, you know, a state health official calling up people that you come into contact with out of the blue, asking who they've been in contact with, advising them to, you know, take certain steps either to get tested or to potentially quarantine, which could affect their job, could affect their personal life, et cetera. So I think, in terms of placing these mobile phone apps within the broader sort of umbrella of contact tracing, they may not be as effective as the traditional type of contact tracing. But in some senses, if you do take certain approaches through the Google Apple framework, for example, they are a little bit more privacy protective. So it's really just a give and take, as we see in so many other areas between security and privacy, and where exactly you'd like to draw the line from either a personal sort of point of view or a state or country level point of view.
Is this the kind of thing that the more people who use the same thing, the better it works?
It certainly is. There's been, you know, research out of Oxford in the UK that suggests, you know, if we get 60% of a given population to download a COVID-19 app, they could be really effective in helping us understand the spread and potentially even limiting the spread of COVID-19. But many public health officials, you know, as I said earlier, mm-hmm. they basically just say more is better. So if they can get 5%, if they can get 10%, more than that, that's seen as a win. If you go to some European countries that have been generally more aggressive with this, mm-hmm. you know, such as Ireland, for example, they have much higher download rates in the 20s, 30s, even 40s of percentage points within their respective countries. And that's when you do see a little bit more effectiveness in terms of the number of notifications that are sent out, basically telling people that, hey, you may have come into contact with someone with COVID-19. So I think more is generally better, but in terms of where the uptake is across states, in the United States, it's generally pretty low within the global context.
And with the data being anonymized, that means I walk into a room and 15 minutes later I get an alert that I might have been, that I was in a room with somebody who's been tested positive for COVID-19. It doesn't tell me which person that was.
It doesn't. It basically, when you download an app, you can give the app, you can give the app your positive test results if you happen to test positive, and you can allow the app to create an anonymized key code, which it will then transmit to other phones via Bluetooth to suggest to them, your phone came in contact with another phone. There's no personal data within that process. That's collected. On a few different occasions with U.S. states, such as in Utah, in South Dakota, and a few others, state governments have considered taking in location data which is obviously a little bit more invasive. You could certainly tell where who a specific person is based on their location, where their, you know, their GPS says they are at night would convey where their home is traditionally. But I think, you know, as I said earlier, privacy has really taken a day in this discussion. So over the course of time, there has been a lot more gravitation toward this Bluetooth technology, which really is anonymized. And privacy experts say it really is protective of your personal data.
How realistic is a national plan? I mean, they can't even agree to mandate wearing masks at this point. Now, President-elect Biden has put together this task force. Are you watching that to see where they're headed on this score?
I mean, I would say, generally speaking, a national plan is unrealistic, particularly with this technology. And if you were to rank the different tools in a toolkit against COVID-19, you know, I think you might put mask wearing at the top, maybe closure of bars and restaurants or concerts up there. I think if you were to ask many public health officials, epidemiologists, people who have fought infectious diseases in places like Western Africa or elsewhere around the world, they would say that this sort of technology, while it's really appealing in some senses, and in the future it might be incredibly effective to help us fight this sort of thing, it might just not be there yet, despite the fact that we have these, you know, extremely powerful tech companies in the United States, and so many people around the country and world have mobile phones in their pockets.
And then as far as any sense about the states, getting more resources from the states to push this?
I mean, certain states are definitely more aggressive about it. You have seen a lot of partnerships from Google and Apple in various state governments. They've been pretty open to, you know, helping individual public health officials to do this. But I do think at the end of the day, you know, when we're talking about state health departments, in many senses, these are pretty small, they're under-resourced, and they're swamped with, you know, exploding case counts in places like, you know, Wisconsin or the Dakotas or in different places in the middle of the country right now. So I think in terms of, you know, when they're allocating resources, while contact tracing apps or COVID-19 apps aren't super expensive, they're probably in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to a few million dollars, depending on the size of your state. I think a lot of these public health departments really are resource strapped. So they're making very tough decisions on a daily basis of where to spend that money. And if they want to get the best bang for their buck, they may not go to these COVID-19 apps. They may go toward more traditional efforts.
Well, David Uberti, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
David Uberti is a cybersecurity reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We've been talking about the use of mobile apps to track COVID-19 cases. Sounded like a good idea last spring, and it's only been implemented in a few states so far. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Fake news may seem like a relatively new term, having just landed in the Oxford English Dictionary in 2019, but spreading false information is as old as time. In the 15th century, the Gutenberg press got things really rolling, but nothing says the potential for fake news like the internet. Former CIA analyst Cindy Otis is the author of the 2020 book, True or False, a CIA analyst's guide to spotting fake news. Welcome, Cindy Otis.
Thanks for having me, Anne.
How do you define fake news?
So I think, you know, it's a pretty common term these days, but the definition has really gotten muddled, particularly by political leaders around the world. But the definition of it that I use is false information that is intentionally being used, created, or spread to manipulate or mislead.
And it's the intentional part is the key there.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we look at something like misinformation, that's a term a lot of folks have probably seen. Misinformation, you know, is the other side of this. So false information spread where the creator or the spreader doesn't know that it's false. It really comes down to intention.
And the but because of the internet, because of social media, a lot of people are unintentionally spreading fake news.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The internet has created this situation where we can reach more people faster than ever before all around the world, which, of course, has a lot of positives. But when it comes to false information, things like, you know, false stories, hoaxes, rumors, conspiracies, things like that, that's certainly the negative side, is that lies can go viral. Or false information can go viral just in seconds.
You know, when I read that in 2018, the Pew Research Center found, well, they asked more than 5,000 adults in America to distinguish between opinions and facts, and most of them could not reliably tell the difference. And that didn't surprise me. When I was a columnist for a number of years, it was surprising to me how many people would say, how can you just say that? And I was like, well, I'm a columnist. I'm giving you my opinion. People didn't seem necessarily to understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the hardest things for people to contend with is that we all have biases. We all are sort of driven by the way that our brain naturally processes information. And a lot of that is determined, you know, by our experiences, by our backgrounds, and that sort of thing. So we all have these lenses through which we look at information. And because we're just, as humans, very uncomfortable with being wrong, and we're also sort of, you know, Americans are sort of naturally confident in ourselves, we do have a hard time differentiating between fact and opinion, because we think if we believe it, it certainly must be true, right? The Pew Research study that you cite is really fascinating in that it asks, it had sort of five instances where they made, you know, statements of things like things about the minimum wage and healthcare and things like that. And the vast majority of adults couldn't tell when something was opinion or when it was fact.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm talking with former CIA analyst Cindy Otis. Her new book is titled True or False, A CIA Analyst's Guide to Spotting Fake News, and that's what we're talking about right now. So the question becomes how to be a more critical news consumer, and your book includes exercises on how to tell a real news story from a fake one. How does it work?
So I do spend a lot of time in my book trying to provide some practical tips that people can employ as they consume information on a daily basis without trying to overwhelm people with steps and trying to turn you all into disinformation investigators like I am. So it really comes down to employing what I hope are a couple of helpful and easy tips and tricks as you consume information. So it starts with first, recognizing that false information largely spreads because it triggers something emotional in us. It plays to our biases. And so when we see content in our social media feeds or on websites that makes us feel particularly strong emotions, the first step there is to really pause before sharing. Another study that was recently done is that it found the vast majority of Americans don't read a news story beyond the headline. The headline triggers something emotional in us. Might be anger, might be fear, might be, you know, a feeling of relief or something like that that confirms sort of our pre-existing opinions. And we go ahead and share it without reading what is in the rest of the article. So stopping and taking stock of the content is really important. And then you can, you know, from there, follow a couple of steps of just looking at who's the source of the information. Is it a random social media account that I can't verify? I don't know who this person is, but they're making a claim. Is it a website? And if I go on the website, can I, you know, look at it and see potentially some very obvious signs of it being a hastily thrown together, for example, WordPress site by somebody who's just sort of quickly populating, a site with some inflammatory stories. They're not, you know, signs that they're not a legitimate media outlet and that sort of thing.
I've noticed Twitter, if you try to retweet something without reading it, and the idea is reading it online. So sometimes I'm trying to retweet something that I've already read but I'm retweeting it later, and they're like, are you sure you want to retweet this if you haven't read it?
Yeah.
Makes you feel kind of guilty. But
yeah, I understand.
Do you think those kind of things work? It works for me. I stop and make sure, you know, that it's what I read and what I'm familiar with. But yeah. Do you think they work in general?
Yeah. So social media platforms, particularly Facebook and Twitter, are testing out right now exactly this kind of thing. And they call it intervention. So something that it sort of forces you to think about, right? Whether it's a exactly as you described, that box that pops up that's like, hey, you know, do you really want to tweet this? Or have you read this? Or it's some other intervention that just causes a person to slow down. It could be even limiting the number of times that you can forward a message in a WhatsApp channel, for example. Research has shown that that does actually cut down on the amount of false information circulating on platforms, because it does do a bit of that guilt tripping, like you mentioned, of, you know, hey, I noticed you didn't actually read the story. Are you sure you know what you're talking about when you share it? That sort of thing. It really does discourage people or encourages them, on the other hand, to be a little bit more thorough in looking at the information that they're passing along.
Why should we be worried about fake social media accounts and you know, separating the wheat from the chaff when it comes to that?
So that's something that I talk about in my book. I give some steps on how you can look for fake accounts, look and identify fake accounts. Social media platforms, particularly, again, Twitter and Facebook, have been pretty public about the fact that there are pretty sizable percentages of what they consider likely fake accounts on their platforms. And various actors, whether it's a foreign government or maybe it's an individual who's motivated by profit, by making money off of, you know, spreading false stories and driving people to their websites where they profit from digital ads, they're employing things like fake accounts to push out particular content. And, you know, I think probably the most well-known case is the Russian government in 2016 through the Internet Research Agency using a whole host of fake trolling accounts to amplify and sow different divisive narratives targeting our election. But certainly there are more players out there using exactly the same strategy.
So a really good friend of mine all of a sudden reached out on Twitter, and, you know, I thought, I don't think he likes Twitter. I'm really surprised he's doing this. And I noticed that a few other people were responding to it. I checked with him. He said, no, I haven't been on Twitter in months, you know, that kind of a thing. He's a retired journalist. And I noticed that it was kind of interesting because he's a very trustworthy person, and people were immediately responding to, hey, how you doing? And I thought, I personally contacted all of them and said, that's not him. And they were grateful. I almost fell for it too.
Yeah.
How can you tell?
So it might have been an individual that was trying to pretend to be a reporter. Mm-hmm. It might have been somebody who stole their profile picture and is trying to do what's called a romance scam, which is a really fascinating part of social media platforms, where essentially primarily individuals who are located in other countries target populations they consider vulnerable. They reach out using profile pictures that they stole, try to strike up conversations with individuals, and then eventually in those conversations, once they feel like they've built some rapport, they start asking for money, things like gift cards and things like that. So that's a really interesting case. But some of the things that people can do is look at, you know, the creation date of a profile, what kinds of content they've been posting since that account was created. So, for example, you know, quickly identifying a spam account would be seeing that it was, you know, recently created, and all they've done since then is post particular links to a particular website, encouraging people to go there. That might be an indication of a spam account created to drive traffic to their website. You can also look at things like the language that they use, whether there are a lot of grammatical errors, a lot of sort of poor English construction, that sort of thing, that might be indicators. And then there's also signs of what's considered automation, or what most people probably know as sort of bot-like behavior. So a bot is an account that's automated. And that might mean that you can spot it pretty quickly if, for example, they're posting 24 hours a day, right? Every 60 to 80 seconds, that would be an obvious sign of automation, because unless the person is superhuman, the chances are that they're able to post 24 hours a day every minute is pretty low.
Your book includes a chapter on polling data and includes the example of the Dewey Truman race and how polling skewed to wealthy people. Why? What do we know about how that applies these days with the polling being so off once again?
Yeah, I mean, I think polling is such an interesting topic. I think it's not something that most Americans are probably interested in, but polling can tell a story. And I think it's important to recognize that for the most part, polls tell a story about a particular point in time in which people were asked particular questions, and a particular set of people were asked those questions. I personally find polling data that tracks trends over time as more relevant and more interesting and sort of what we can learn from them. But I give a couple of tips in that particular chapter that you mentioned about how to make sure that, you know, you're sort of looking at polling data correctly. And that's things like looking into who are the polling firms that are actually conducting these polls. Mm-hmm. Were they, you know, paid for example, by a political campaign? And then, you know, the political campaign is, of course, interested in telling a particular story with the results when they release them, right? Looking at the time period in which the polling was conducted, making sure that the sample size is representative of sort of the larger demographics. For example, if you want to know sort of how a particular set of individuals feel in a city in the United States, let's say Chicago, you're not going to go conduct a poll out of New York City, right? So it's sort of basic things like that you want to look into before you take polls too seriously. And I think you also have to recognize too that, you know, the nature of polls are changing over time as more people move to cell phones,
right?
Cell phones that automatically block spam-like numbers. Coronavirus means people are staying indoors and not necessarily voting at polling stations, which makes exit polls, you know, sort of questionable and that sort of thing.
Your work with the CIA included analyzing foreign threats. How do you distinguish between these real threats from invented ones? What's the difference?
So I spent 10 years at the CIA, most of my time as an analyst and then as a manager. And the job of an analyst is to comb through large amounts of information and intelligence and data on a daily basis to try to paint a picture for U.S. policymakers about what is happening with very often very quickly moving global events. And it's a challenge as an analyst to first be able to consume that kinds of, you know, that scale of information on a daily basis, but then also weed out what is, you know, potentially false, what is potentially, you know, intentionally false, created by foreign governments to deceive or manipulate or mislead. That was essentially the impetus for my book is the skills and tactics that I used as a CIA analyst, I think are actually very helpful to people who are just trying to make sense of their social media feeds and the news that they see online. So as an analyst, you're taught from day one to do things like check your own biases, to recognize what sort of information lens you have that might color or, you know, affect the way in which you look at information. All of those steps that I mentioned previously of pausing when there's particular content that makes you feel a certain way, and then investigating things like sources, those were all the things that intelligence analysts do on a daily basis.
It's hard for people to force themselves to follow on social media someone or something that they don't agree with.
Yeah, absolutely. It is part of what I think is necessary in terms of understanding what other people are saying about things, making you think about your own views and analysis. I do think that it is important to, for example, read from a wide variety of sources. Mm-hmm. Because again, we sort of constantly have to confront the fact that, you know, again, we're very uncomfortable with being wrong. And as a result, that means we're often less likely to take in new evidence as we're confronted with it. and new facts, because, you know, if it's going to prove us wrong, we just don't like it. But it's just very important to make sure that we're sort of constantly reassessing our views and ideas based on new evidence as it comes about. And of course, I'm not saying at all that, you know, when your friend, for example, posts a YouTube video of them ranting about fill in the blank political topic, mm-hmm. That you should completely readjust all of your thinking on that particular topic. But certainly as new evidence presents itself, that it's important to sort of reassess how we think about things.
Your book is a practical guide for anyone, but you initially targeted it to teens, those in grades 8 mm-hmm. and up. How come and how did that change the tenor of the book for you? Why did you decide to do that?
Yeah, so you know, a large population of the readers are certainly adults, but I did intentionally write it for teens. And that was for a couple of reasons. So, you know, the folks of my generation, I grew up in the generation where people started to get internet in their homes. That was more and more common. In my generation, we went from having, you know, hard copy encyclopedias to having the encyclopedia online. And we created social media. And essentially, we've created this massive information structure. Our worlds are online now, and we've sort of brought our young people up in it. They're online since the day they were born, when in the delivery room, we're taking pictures of them and posting them on Facebook almost immediately. Mm-hmm. And we haven't necessarily given them the tools that they need to make sense of their online environment, because we're still figuring out ourselves. And there are a lot of sort of perils and pitfalls that we can all fall into as a result. And so I wanted to make sure that the information that I was including in this book was going to be helpful for teens, because I think when we talk about solutions, how do you solve this problem of false information just sort of overpowering our online spaces, is we need to build populations or educate populations that are more resilient in the face of false information, that have have the tools and tactics that they need to be able to not fall for these things, at least the obvious things, but know how to question and ask questions about the sources of things that they're seeing.
Do you think they do enough in the curriculum, on just our regular school curriculums, when they're growing? Do you think that's a role for schools?
It's absolutely a role for schools. I think, you know, it very much depends on, you know, the state and the school districts in terms of how much they're doing on this issue. There are a couple of nonprofit organizations that are doing just absolutely crucial work in this space. I would specifically mention my colleagues at the News Literacy Project, who are phenomenal. They've created a number of resources that teachers, public educators, and now even the wider U.S. population can access for free. That is online trainings that people can use to learn skills and tactics. It's all free for educators. So there are organizations out there like the News Literacy Project doing this important work. I think the key is we need to understand that in terms of public education, news literacy, digital media literacy, information consumption, all of these things should be integrated into every part of our education system.
Well, Cindy Otis, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Anne.
Cindy Otis is a former CIA analyst and the author of the 2020 book, True and False, a CIA analyst's guide to spotting fake news. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The much-anticipated Sony PlayStation 5 has arrived, but pre-orders have already sold out in 12 hours. It took its predecessor, PlayStation 4, 12 weeks to do the same. Russell Holly, contributing editor of Android Central, is here to tell us more. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, before the PlayStation 4, there were those who said console gaming was dead. Apparently not. What's going on?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, we've moved into a new age of console gaming where a big part of it is social and a big part of it is, you know, streaming videos and being able to play with friends. It doesn't look like it did, you know, back in kind of the PlayStation 3 days, but a big part is this kind of immersion feeling where you kind of feel like you're a part of the game as you go and play it. And that has, you know, been very, very true with the PlayStation 5. It, you know, a lot of the things from the previous generation have gone away. It's not as loud. People who currently own a PlayStation 4 or PlayStation 4 Pro will know that sometimes when you get really into a game, the fans can kick on inside of that console and it gets pretty loud. It's almost like there's a leaf blower inside your house, depending on where you've got it set up. That doesn't happen with the PlayStation 5. It's significantly faster. And it has a new controller. And one of the really cool things about that new controller is it has these incredibly comfortable, buttons that actually push back against you when you're doing things inside of the game to make it feel, you know, kind of a little more realistic.
There are two price points. What's the difference?
One has a drive for you to put discs in, be they Blu-ray discs or the actual PlayStation 5 discs. Whereas the other version is an all-digital version where there is no disk drive, in a very similar sense to what Microsoft had been doing.
What's the difference in prices?
It's about $100 difference in price.
So it has the controller. Talk a little bit more about that. It's a DualSense controller?
Yeah, DualSense is what Sony calls their controllers. We've had DualShock in the past, and now they're called DualSense.
Okay.
And a big part of that that controller is having these two, you know, kind of special, triggers on the back, where not only is it give you more information when there's some vibration sensors that are in the controllers, and those vibrators have been inside of these controllers for quite a while now, to kind of rumble along with you as you're playing a game. They're a lot more intuitive and a lot more granular now. But one of the really cool things it does is when you actually squeeze the triggers on the back to do something in a game, if the game has a reaction, you'll actually feel that reaction in the joystick. So maybe someone is kind of pushing against you in a game or something like that. You'll actually feel that in the controller.
So interesting. The model comes out on Thursday. You said that it's sold out. I said that it's sold out. Pre-orders have sold out in 12 hours. What does this mean? I mean, can Sony keep up with the demand? What are we looking at?
It's going to be very difficult, in very much the same way that getting an Xbox right now is pretty difficult. It's going to be very difficult to get a hold of a PlayStation if you have not already pre-ordered it. There will be some online sales available on Thursday. We know that Amazon's website, as well as GameStop and Walmart.com, will have a bunch available to purchase on that day. But if you're looking to go into a store and actually pick one up because you had not already pre-ordered one, those will not be available. So on Thursday, if you try and walk into a GameStop without a pre-order to pick one up, they're just not going to have them for a little while. It'll be a couple weeks.
And do you think this is COVID-19 related?
No, I think, honestly, Sony, a lot of what we've seen with this game console is that Sony is kind of really up against the wire here. You know, it took them a while to get the consoles into the hands of people who were reviewing them. Mm-hmm. It took Sony a little bit of time to get the initial pre-orders out compared to Microsoft. I think they just were a few weeks behind as far as getting them, ready to ship, ready to sell. Compared to Microsoft, and so they're just, you know, they're the amount of them that they could produce is still just a few weeks behind. I don't think this will be a huge issue before the holiday season comes. If someone is looking to buy one as a gift, there's a pretty good chance that will still be something that happens in the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
But if you're one of those people who are just very excited about having one, you know, on the day that they're sold, you may run into some challenges.
Okay. Apple's next wave of laptops is to be revealed today. There's a virtual press conference. What do you think they're going to talk about?
Yeah, so this is the step of what is probably going to be something very new for Apple. What we heard in their last big presentation that wasn't about an iPhone was that Apple had made their own processors. The last couple of years, everything that Apple has made has had a processor in it from Intel. So the computers, you buy a MacBook or something like that, it has an Intel processor in it. And so they had to buy those processors from Intel and then put them in their computers. Apple's now making their own processors. These are their own things. These are bigger and better versions of the kind of processors that are in the phones right now, which are already great processors, but not the kind of thing you would put in a computer. This is something we're going to see as Apple's going to take to the stage today and explain why these are better, what makes them faster, what makes them, maybe not as good. And the big thing Apple is expected to talk about is battery life. When you put one of these lower power processors, these lower output processors in a laptop like this, the big batteries that are put in them will last a great deal longer. But what we don't know is what the trade-off there is. How much performance will you lose when you're doing things like editing video or editing photos? And so that will depend on who these laptops are for, as far as who they get recommended to.
Well, who are they for?
Well, we'll know more once Apple tells us what the general performance of it is. If these end up, doing the same things as far as, being able to edit photos and videos without any kind of real interruption to performance, then these could be great, kind of professional machines that could be taken anywhere. And then, the additional battery would be great. If these are a little simpler, if they're meant to be kind of ultra light and ultra thin machines that can browse the web really well and edit documents and things like that, then these are probably going to be more aimed towards, college students or people who are, kind of in offices, not doing graphically intense things every day.
Do you have a personal preference, what you're hoping for?
I think Apple has done a really great job with the ultra lightweight thing over the last couple of years. The MacBooks have been very good. Being able to deliver that with a better battery seems more likely to be the direction that Apple would want to head in. Being able to do that for less than $1,000 would put them in a competitive space against Samsung and Google and Microsoft for the moment. So that seems the most likely right now.
How do people respond to these upgrades and these changes as far as, now that we're deeply into this after 25 years of computers, what's your sense about how much people change up at this point?
I think when most people go to change their computer, what they're looking for is a better battery, a nicer screen, and for it to be fast. Because usually when people have a computer and they upgrade it, those are the three things that are no longer as good. Your battery dies over time. Your screen is, a few years back as far as its performance. So you go into a store and you see, wow, this thing is way thinner than mine, way that this thing is way faster than mine, and the piece of paper says that the battery lasts way longer than mine does. I think that ends up being the main driver for most folks when it comes to making a change. I don't think there are a lot of people who switch on a regular basis between Windows and Mac. I think that, once you kind of get one and you're happy with it, you stick there. But I think that what it really comes down to for most people is that kind of the performance basics. It's really not all that different from your phone. I think if you were to tell someone that your phone could only launch Facebook and make phone calls, but it was a battery that would last 6 months on a single charge, there's probably a lot of people who would very happily buy that phone.
Right. Oh, and don't forget the camera.
And the camera.
Because really, it's a camera with a phone app on it. Amazon's new Fire TV sticks are super cheap, but you get what you pay for, huh?
Yeah, so Amazon has been doing these Fire TV devices for a while now. They started out as little boxes that sat next to your television, and then the Fire TV stick came out where it just plugged into the port behind the television.
And you like these entirely.
These are great. They're great at just kind of disappearing behind the television. It's very similar to the Roku stick, and that when you sit down, all you need is the remote control. You don't have to do anything else, and there's a ton of different things to stream from. And Amazon has been very good at making these, every year, just slightly faster and kind of operating on more televisions and kind of being a little more user-friendly. And there was a little bit of time there where Amazon was trying to add voice features to it, where you kind of press a button and talk to your TV as though it were, you know, one of its smart speakers, mm-hmm. which I will not say its name at the risk of getting angry tweets from some of your listeners. So, you know, that feature seems to have gone away a little bit in this latest
feature. What do you think?
This latest set. I think it's probably something that not as many people used. I think that the idea of talking to your television in the average household is probably not something that happens very often, if for no other reason than there are lots of households full of 6 and 7 year olds who would happily run through your house while you are watching something and shout at the television and get it to change the channel just because it's funny.
Yeah. Ha ha ha.
So that, right. You know, so that's probably not something that everyone wanted, is that kind of universal voice access for their television. You know, these still have voice controls, but they're limited to the remote control. There's a microphone button on the remote that you have to hold down in order to talk into it. We've got two different versions this year. We've got the $28 Amazon Fire TV Stick, which is, you know, already a pretty great price and does everything that it's supposed to for most televisions. And then what they call the Fire TV Stick Lite, which is $18. Hmm. There's two, you know, really significant differences between these devices. The very inexpensive one, the $18 one, does not allow you to control your television, which means if you want to adjust the volume on your television, or you want to be able to press a button on your Fire TV Stick and have your television just kind of spring to life like a lot of other boxes have, this cheaper version will not do that. It's just, you know, just for connecting to the existing television and operating, you know, on that kind of basic level. Whereas the $28 version does include that kind of basic, you know, kind of TV control where you can increase and decrease the volume. But what it doesn't support is 4K video. So if you have a 4K television and you plug this stick in, you will notice that the video quality isn't quite as good as it probably should be, which is a notable difference.
Yeah.
You know, when compared to Google's Chromecast and the Roku sticks. But they are more expensive. You know, the Chromecast device is almost $50 and the Roku stick is $45. You know, so that's the difference here. If you want a 4K version, Amazon does make a 4K stick, but it is also, you know, kind of up in that $50 price range. Hmm. So this is designed to be just a very inexpensive, you know, TV streaming device.
You know, that whole spring into life thing, I just figured that out. I was always monkeying around with the power thing, and now I don't need to even get that out anymore.
That whole thing came from, you know, years of people saying, wouldn't it be great if I just had one remote control?
Yeah.
And, you know, in order to do that, you needed to have whatever was plugged into the television be able to also give instructions to the television. So now it's kind of common, which is why it was so weird to see it missing from this very inexpensive Fire TV stick. But yeah, it's, you know, if you want just kind of the bare minimum, something that allows you to stream Netflix and doesn't control, you know, the volume of any kind, then the Fire TV Stick Lite is great. And something actually one of our other reviewers said that made a lot of sense to me is this is probably the perfect stick for, like, the doctor's office, where you can put the remote in, you know, the receptionist behind the counter can control the volume, but the person who wants to watch something in the waiting room of the doctor's office can choose what it is to watch. And that actually made a great deal of sense to me. But I imagine that Amazon probably has a lot more people interested in this than just doctor's offices.
Yeah, I know. But it's been a great improvement to the waiting. Well, although, of course, pandemic, you don't wait that much anymore. But you just sit and watch some HGTV while you're waiting for your doctor or your dentist. I think it's awesome. But, you know, not much waiting going on. How's that Christmas list coming, or holiday gift list, I should say?
Yeah, so we're gonna start that next week. We're gonna start 3 weeks of holiday gift guides for everyone here,
yep.
Where we break down, you know, kind of different things for different you know, kind of age categories, and make sure that this is all stuff that can be ordered ahead of time, because shipping for things is gonna get a little crazy as we move closer to the holiday season. So we're gonna try and do that a little earlier than we have in past years.
Exactly. Well, anyways, thanks for all your help, Russell Holly. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.